Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch. For this night, and all the nights to come.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Game of Thrones. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you are just joining us, what we are in the middle of doing is counting down, or actually we've passed the midpoint, counting down the top 15 episodes of Game of Thrones leading up to season 8. We've been running in chronological order until we get to the last episode, episode number 15, which we have decided is going to be the most essential, the best episode of Game of Thrones. But for right now, we're in the midst of a chronological countdown. We're in season 4. You can go back and listen to all of our episodes leading up to this. Richard and I talk about each episode as we go. And then we've got great interviews with people who have worked on the show this week. Back by popular demand, actually, is co-executive producer Brian Cogman. People really liked his interview on Kiss by Fire, so he came back to chat with us about The Children, which is the episode we're talking about today, season 4, episode 10, the finale, The Children, which is written by Weiss and Benioff and directed by Alex Graves. Before we get into our discussion of that episode, we wanted to remind you all that if you want to read all of our Game of Thrones coverage, and there will be a lot of it for the final season, season 8, and want to get past that paywall that we have going right now, you can go to vanityfair.com/thrones, enter promo code Thrones, and then you get a discounted deal, which is 1 year for $15. 1 year, $15, print and digital. Richard, can you think of a better deal ever?
Well, I don't know, paying one coin to take a boat across the sea. That's a pretty good deal. So,
it's,
you know,
but
if you don't have your Magic Aria coin, then yes, this is probably the best thing there is out there.
Yeah, if you do have a Magic Aria coin given to you by Jaqen H'ghar and, like, covered in blood or whatever it is, and you want to type in promo code Valor Morghulis and try to drop that coin and get the 1 year subscription, you can go ahead and give that a shot. That might work as well. But if that doesn't work for you, then try promo code Thrones to get that discount. So we want you guys to be in on the conversation with us all through season 8. So, get past the paywall, get this discount, get that going. All right. Here we go. Season 4, episode 10. This is the season finale. This is our first season finale that we've talked about because I think it's the first, like, good or maybe great season finale that Game of Thrones ever had. Usually they were famous for their episodes 9, but this is episode 10. Here's my 15-word recap of the episode, which covers it all. The Clegane brothers live, dragons are on timeout, and Tywin goes to the bathroom. So I think that's it. That's all we need to talk about. Done and dusted.
I mean, you could have said privy, but yes.
Privy. Ugh, that would have been much classier. All right. My backup was Tywin never gets off the pot, but like that seemed too unclassy. So, anyway, so Richard and I are going to dole out a few awards for this episode before talking generally about why it is one of the essential Game of Thrones episodes. We're going to start with our obvious MVP of the episode. My obvious MVP of this episode, The Children, is Brienne of fucking Tarth. Richard, what do you say?
I mean, I don't think you can really beat that. Well, no, maybe my MVP is, obvious MVP is a little tree child with the fire bombs.
Leaf, yes.
Leaf.
And then that's a good one. Then sneaky MVP. I'm going to go with Qyburn, Anton Lesser. We had seen a little bit of what Qyburn was interested in when he sort of helped Jaime earlier, in the series, but here he is going full like mad scientist with his like gross tubes and prodding of the mountain and all that sort of stuff. And his like real intro to his, necrophilia sort of, well, that's maybe a bit too far, his interest in the dead, let's say. Richard, who's your sneaky MVP of the episode?
That cool thing that Tyrion uses to like ratchet the crossbow, the tool, the loading tool.
Yeah.
I don't know what the name of that is, but
the crossbow ratchet.
Sure. I forgot why he was carrying it in the hallway. Then I was like, oh, right.
Yeah, you're like, what's he dragging? What's that sound? And it's like, oh, yeah, here we go. All right. And then this is the part that we do that I have forced Richard into, which is we perform a quote from the episode. I will say we've generally gotten good feedback on this podcast series. People are liking it. The only feedback I've heard is like, maybe don't do the quote thing. And I'm like, you know what? That makes me want to do the quote thing even more. So, here we go with our terrible impressions of characters from Game of Thrones. I'm going to go first. I go, manticle venom. That's my Maester Pycelle impression.
Yeah, that's good.
What do you got, Richard?
Mine is a simple, fuck it, I'm ready. Which is what Clegane says to Arya, thinking she's about to kill him.
Oh, beautiful. A lot of, like, I could hear the fake blood in your mouth as you were
good.
Saying that.
Well, I actually do have some blood in my mouth, yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. Your podcasting ritual. All right. And then we're going to do best dressed. I'm going to use your MVP for this one. Actually, mine is Leaf, the child of the forest, because she's got like this great, you know, leafy ensemble as she pops up to save the day. Who's your best dressed of this episode?
You know, I think for someone on the toilet, Tywin looks pretty dignified.
Yeah. He's got that a flowing black sort
his,
of number
his
going on.
Night cloak. Yeah.
Yeah. And then our ship, the people that we are shipping in this episode, either an item or two people. I am wishing for Bran to meet a pair of scissors, and get a nice haircut. This is the peak Bran bad hair before he gets back to some better hair, when he returns. But what is your ship for this episode, Richard?
It's somewhat Bran related too. I'm shipping Jojen Reed and not dying.
All right. So, let's talk about this episode more broadly. This was, you know, there was a huge leap in the viewership between season 3 and season 4 because the Red Wedding was like such a famously, bananas thing that happened at the end of season 3. A lot more people are watching the show now. But, the end of this book, Storm of Swords, that George R. R. Martin wrote, so much crazy shit happens. And so you just have like enough to ring you all the way through the end of season 4. You've got the Mountain of the Viper, which we already talked about, which is a huge enough on its own. Then you've got the whole cattle, then you've got the whole battle for Castle Black. Ygritte dies, all of that happens. And then you have everything that happens here. Tywin's dead, Shay's dead, you know, Child of the Forest appears, all of this crazy shit happens. So, and Arya leaves Westeros and Tyrion leaves Westeros and the Hound seems like he dies, but he doesn't. It's a bananas time in Game of Thrones. This episode got, I think, a lot of acclaim from people, especially it ends with Arya leaving Westeros and this choral version of the theme starts playing, and it just felt like a more of a statement ending than we've ever seen yet so far on Game of Thrones. Richard, yeah. Why does this episode seem like a big deal to you?
Well, that ending is really beautiful, and it's also the first time that I can think of that a major character other than Dany like left Westeros, especially as, you know, it's first, definitely the first Stark to kind of leave that world and set off on a new adventure that would bring her far afield and eventually, of course, back to the main action. Mm-hmm. So that felt significant. I think that Jojen dying was interesting because am I remembering correctly that he's not dead in the books yet?
Yeah, this is a big one. They pulled, so that stuff with Bran and Jojen, is from book 5, and they sort of pulled it forward, to give Bran, I guess, like some sort of cap to his journey in this season. And so where we left, you know, since George R. Martin has not published any books beyond book 5 yet, where we left Bran in the books is they're approaching the cave. There's like an implication that maybe Jojen has died, but he has not actually died in the books.
Right. Yet, so. And I think that in just kind of bringing Bran's narrative like up to the end of book 5 is this finale, if I remember correctly, kind of marked for me like the, okay, now here we are, like Arya heading off into the unknown, because we are now not completely out of book material, but we are out of some of it. At this point, you know, season 4 was really when they exhausted a lot of it, for some characters. And so it feels like a significant moment. And I don't necessarily know that I love what comes next as much as I loved what came before. But it's still a crux thing and which makes it interesting to talk about. And I think there are a lot of great things in this episode.
Yeah, season 4, I think, really is a high point of the series. And I think you're right. This was also a big moment in the fandom, I think, in terms of, at the end of this book in, George R. R. Martin's book series. And I don't think this is spoiling anything for anyone because this is not happening on the show. But the end of this book, Catelyn Stark is resurrected into this figure called Lady Stoneheart. And so a bunch of book fans were expecting that that's how this was going to end. And this episode is called The Children. And so they're like, you know, get it. She's the mom of the kids and that's what's going to happen and all this sort of stuff. And it didn't. And there are a few other changes to bringing the Bran stuff forward. The way that Tyrion leaves is a little different. Like the way he kills Shay is a little different. The way he leaves Jaime is a little different. This is really like, feels like a bit of a flex, you know, in terms of like, moving from a straight adaptation to more adaptive choices. The showrunners, the writers in the show saying more firmly, this is our narrative. It's going to be a little different than the narrative, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm exactly. So it's a really significant episode in that, you know, and I think that like rewatching it and you know, as we head into the kind of later seasons, you know, I am starting to see the value in the way that the show kind of takes its own license, you know, because when I was watching the show like in real time back then, like the books were a lot fresher in my head and I felt a lot more loyal to them, and I felt maybe sort of in vain, dimly sure that George R. R. Martin would finish the books. And so I was like, well, let's just, you know, we should have waited or something like that. And now I'm kind of, you know, 5 years later, I'm more of the mindset of like, all right, like, I don't care who ends the story, just like, let's end it. I want to see how it ends. So I think I'm a lot more forgiving of the show, you know, departing, from the given narrative. Even if it means that an interesting character like Jojen, who I think probably might have served a bigger role along with his sister Mira, has to go.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel the same way about Mance Rayder. Like, this is a good this episode opens with some really great, I think, Mance Rayder stuff. Kieran Hines is a great actor in that role. That's a figure that in the books, you know, we does indeed do a bit more than he ever does on the show, and we expect to be very important going forward. And the show's like, guess, you know, eventually, you know, spoiler alert for, you know, what's coming up, but like, Mance ends up being not that consequential. And overall, if you think back on the show, Mance Rayder is very low on the list of characters that you think of as like being important. But watching this episode and watching his interaction with John, which is so satisfying as they sort of toast their fallen friends and all of that, it's interesting to think of what might have been. And then also just, yeah, with time and distance, you have to respect the tougher choices that they've had to make on this adaptation. So, or not, your mileage may vary, but I find myself being less of a stuck up book nerd, on this rewatch, you know? So.
Yeah. And I think that like this kind of shaking off of the old ways is happening, you know, obviously elsewhere in this episode with Tywin dying. You know, that was inevitable. We book readers knew that was coming. It's a great scene. It's very well done. But it also, you know, means that, well, it means that Tyrion is, his fate is now kind of cast to the wind. It means Cersei now is sort of without, a particular sort of guiding person, you know, kind of looming above her. And so it frees characters up in a way that is risky, certainly, and maybe not all the risks that the show takes or the story takes pay off. But like, you have to do that if you're going to have a show that goes on for season after season after season. It can't all exist under the same kind of tight, you know, framework or rubric, because people would get bored. So, you know, this episode stands kind of as testament, I think, to a lot of risky narrative choices, you know, getting rid of old character, beloved characters, sending other beloved characters into hold different, you know, new situations with, you know, so they won't be interacting with anyone else we already know. Like, it's an interesting equation that they have to do. And, I think that there are moments in this episode where they just handle it so well. Again, that ending scene with Arya is just, I think, such a gorgeous, almost little tribute to itself, you know, like, it's almost like the show being like, well, here we go, guys. And like, one of our youngest cast members is, you know, leading the charge. I think it's nice.
Yeah, I completely agree. And there's also just like that great performance from Maisie in this episode with the Hound. Like Arya just, you know, that is straight from the books, right? That's a straight book adaptation, but it's like in her performance, watching her mature over the seasons. And then, you know, like Arya then goes into a plot line. You know, it's brave of the show to send her off on the plot line. I think your mileage may vary whether or not you enjoy her time in Braavos, but this feels like a real leap forward into who this character is and will become. And I think Maisie, like, well, here's what I'll say. I'll say there are some points down the road where I think Arya is almost too robotic in a way that it's hard for me to access. Mm-hmm. And here you have her giving that like sort of flat assessment of the Hound, but there's still so much humanity going on, in that performance, in like Maisie's eyes and stuff like that, that I think is really captivating.
Yeah, totally. I mean, if you wanted to stretch a little bit, you could say that this is a metaphor or an allegory for a young person going off to war. And, you know, Arya is going off because she thinks she has some sort of principled thing. I mean, yes, in her principle, it's about getting revenge. But like, who could say that, you know, young soldiers who signed up for the military after 9/11 weren't in some way seeking revenge in Afghanistan, you know, and that she's hardened by it. It's not exactly what she expects. And she comes back a little bit. I don't want to call people with PTSD broken. They're certainly not broken, but altered, you know? So I think you could maybe infer that if you wanted to write a paper about it, but I'm not encouraging anyone to do that, but there's a free idea if you want it.
Please cite Richard as your source. Yeah. And so this, as we mentioned, this is the last episode for a few characters, most specifically Tywin Lannister, I think is the character maybe we miss the most going forward, not because he's like the best, you know, most virtuous character, but because Charles Dance is just such a delight in every single like scene that he was in. And so it's a good goodbye for him. I love this scene in the book. If I remember correctly, in the scene in the book, there's a famous line where it's like, you know, contrary to the rumor for years or something like that, Tywin Lannister did not in the end shit gold or something like that. Which is a great George R. R. Martin line. But, you know, they give Tywin a lot to do in this episode, not just this death scene, but also this earlier scene with Cersei, where he learns some information that I believe Tywin actually never learns or really reckons with in the book, about his kids, and just Charles's performance through all of that is, you know, I love this send off for him.
Yeah. And I think we also have to say an RIP to Shay. Who, you know, I was rewatching this scene. I guess I don't really remember in the books, but like, it's hard with the show. I think with Jaime and Tyrion, you know, like trying to make relatable, likable human characters out of people who do really terrible things. Like with this thing with Shay, where it's like, did he have to kill her? You know? And if he was killing her out of a sense of jealousy or whatever, like, that's not good, but we're still supposed to be kind of rooting for him. So it's a really complicated thing, but I think that, you know, that aside, like, I'm glad that Shay, I mentioned it on a past episode, I'm glad that Shay gets more of a sort of presence in the show. I mean, she's in the book, but like, this death feels bigger, on screen, because we've gotten to know her a little bit better. So, you know, she's one of those many characters kind of who were in like a season or two and then kind of got lost along the way, but should not be forgotten.
Yeah, absolutely. And they tweaked it a little bit. I don't know. I think Cybill Kelly, who played that character, got kind of a bum rap from fans throughout. And, you know, I think especially in this rewatch, I've really appreciated a lot of what she had to do, a lot of sort of the obstructionist role she had to play in certain respects. So there's all of that. And then there's also like, so Jojen dies. I think you texted me like, I can't believe you made me watch Jojen die again. But also, or no, that was on the Twitters, but also, there's this like crazy VFX scene with these skeleton whites sort of attacking him. And, you know, looking back, it's not the best VFX scene that Game of Thrones has ever done, but mm-hmm. It was at the time a leap forward for them, because we hadn't seen the Army of the Dead in that state of decomposition before. You know, so they sort of did this like, it felt kind of like a throwback sort of, it's what, Ray Harryhausen? Yeah, I mm-hmm. pronounce that. Yeah. Like a sort of Ray Harryhausen, like almost claymation skeletal thing, but a little different. But I don't know. It's just, I think a lot of people were taken by surprise by seeing that.
What did it remind me of? There's something that's very similar in a movie with like skeletons with swords. If anyone listening.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
No, it's something older that looks more like stop motion-y.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, Ray Harryhausen, I think, like a Sinbad sort of,
Is that what I'm thinking of specifically?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if someone knows, if there's a specific thing that I'm forgetting, it might be a video game. That's also possible. From like my youth, but anyway,
Jason on the Argonauts, I think, is the Ray Harryhausen. It's something that it gets compared to, but maybe you're thinking of a video
and game. It's skeletons.
Yeah. Skeletons.
Okay. That's what I'm thinking of then, almost certainly. But yeah, it's an interesting scene, you know, it's easy to forget that this is kind of a zombie show. Not always, but like, sometimes it just is. And they're not zombies in that they're like popping out of the ground. They've been lying in wait. Like they have tools. Like they're not quite zombies, but like, it's close enough that you're like, oh, right. And it's creepy, you know, it's a creepy scene. It's well done. I remember it being unexpected. It's definitely a sign of things to come. Particularly with the next episode we're going to cover, hint, hint.
Yeah. And another flex for the show is that this is, you know, Bran Stark and Mira and Hodor take a whole season off. After this, you know,
yeah,
that's just and that's something that George R. R. Martin does in his books much more characters take entire books off, you know, and I think the show, rightly so, does not want to do that too much because it doesn't want to like make you forget, you know, who was Bran Stark again, blah, blah, blah. So they did it sparingly. But yeah, Bran and the crew go away for a whole season. So,
yeah, that's something I wonder if just watchers of the show don't realize, is that like book four, like most of your favorite characters are not in. you know?
Well, and that's, yeah, and that's why, you know, we'll talk about, well, we'll talk about this in our next episode, maybe a little bit more, but that's why you get some extreme adaptive choices like Sansa Stark going to Winterfell. Because that's how you keep Sansa, well, it's a way to keep Sansa Stark in the narrative,
right.
At all. So, yeah, that's part of it. All right. Is there anything else you want to say about, the children before we move on?
No, I think it's time to get on the prow of that ship and just sail off to Braavos, or rather to our next episode.
All right. So stay tuned. We have a great interview with a co-executive producer and writer, Brian Cogman.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Popular demand, we have co-executive producer Brian Cogman. Hello, Brian Cogman. Welcome back.
Back by overwhelming, unbelievable popular demand. Just internet-breaking popular
back,
demand.
Not
I'm
because
sure.
I begged you, but because...
Yeah, not because someone failed at the last minute. That's okay. Right. That's my whole career in a nutshell. This is par for the course.
Oh, okay. That's beautiful. But okay. But when I did ask you to do this, you knocked my socks off by telling me that this might be your favorite episode of Game of Thrones, which I thought the last one we talked about, but I think the distinction is the last one we talked about, which is Kiss by Fire, is the favorite episode of Game of Thrones that you wrote.
Indeed.
This might be your favorite overall. Is that correct?
Yes, I have many episodes I like better than any of the ones I wrote. So yeah, Kiss by Fire is my favorite of my scripts, but I think this might be, you know, it's neck and neck between The Children and Winds of Winter. And both sort of represent two very, I don't know, distinct phases of the show in some ways. So maybe that's why it's hard for me to choose, because there's sort of phase two, which is season five on, and then the first four seasons. So, but I rewatched The Children last night, and it might be my favorite if only because there's one sustained sequence that I think is the best thing we've ever done that's in The Children, so that might give it the edge. But then again, when I rewatch Winds of Winter, because I'm doing a little bit of a rewatch myself for cathartic reasons, I'll probably change my mind then. So they're neck and neck, but for now, sure. Let's say The Children is my favorite.
Well, this is what I appreciate about you, Brian Cogman, is you always do your homework, and I really appreciate you rewatching the episode. I know, not just for me, probably for
no, it was my pleasure. It threw off my watching order, because I'm only in the middle of season two right now.
Are you gonna make it?
I don't know if I am, actually. I was hoping I would, and you know, my actual, you know, job keeps getting in the way.
This is the part where I'm going to try to guess what you think is the sustained sequence that might be the best thing you guys have ever done. What does Brian Cogman like? He likes character. I'm going to go with Tyrion's escape. Is that your sequence?
Well, I love it. No.
No.
But I love that sequence.
What
That's
is it?
Not to disparage that sequence in any way.
No. What is it?
To be fair, I say sequence, it's really three scenes strung together. So it's about, I should have clocked it when I watched it, but it's probably, it's about 10 minutes or so. If maybe a little longer. It is, Brienne meeting Arya. Brienne fights the Hound. Arya leaves the Hound.
That was my second guess.
Yeah. I think that is my favorite 10 or so minutes of Game of Thrones. And that was backed up again when I watched it last night. It really knocks my socks off for a lot of reasons. And I have a personal connection to it too, because I rarely got to be the ranking writer producer on set in anywhere that wasn't Belfast, but because David and Dan, since it's their show, seem to find themselves in places like Spain and Croatia, while Brian did Belfast. And I love Belfast. This gave me a career because the two of them cannot be separated. So so they manned one set and I always manned the other one, and we always had two main units going. So it, you know, that was my trial by fire. But I got to do 2 weeks in Iceland for season four that we shot in the summer. There was one season where we shot in the summer. So the majority of the Arya Hound exteriors from season four are actually shot in Iceland. Mm. And then a couple of other bits too from the wildling raid on that little village on Ollie's village is in Iceland as well, and a couple other scenes. So I was the ranking writer producer on set for that sequence. So it's sort of near and dear to me, but I love every, to me, it's a perfect example of us adapting something wonderful that George did from the book, but putting our own spin on it and making it work within the context of our show. And the final scene with him and Arya, if you watch it closely, if you've been watching the entire season, it calls back virtually every emotional touch point of their journey. He calls back in all the dialogue, every conversation they've had in the previous season, in the previous episodes of the season, it very subtly. And I love Rory's work and Maisie's work in that scene just astonished me. The fight scene is the most brutal. In recent interviews, we've sort of talked about how the Jamie-Danny face-off was the first time you had a face-off where you really, you know, didn't know who to root for. And that's not entirely true. I think what it was, I think the reason it hit us all so hard, and we've been saying that in interviews, is I think arguably it's the first time you've seen Danny face off against someone and you're not sure if you're rooting for Danny.
Right.
I think it's safe to say that. Pretty much any adversary she had previous to Jamie, it's like obvious who you're rooting for. So anyway, that said, I really, truly think the Hound-Brienne fight, you could maybe make the argument for Ygritte and the Wildlings, but I don't think anyone's really rooting for the Wildlings to destroy all the Night's Watch. I think even though you like Ygritte and you like Tormund, you want Jon to win, at least maybe. I mean, at least I do. But truly, I think with the Hound and Brienne fight, at that point, and I think specifically, it comes down to one line for me. I even got choked up watching it last night when he says he's protecting Arya right before the fight starts.
Yeah.
That's when, if you've had any doubt about him up until that point, you love him, because he lets his heart out in that moment very briefly. She says, that's what you're doing, protecting her. That's what I'm doing. And it's oh no, you just realize, oh no, I don't know who I want to win this fight, you know? So the brutality of that fight and the fact that both of them are absolutely right in doing what they're doing from their point of view, which I think is the other beauty of George's books and hopefully our show, is that you always understand where each character is coming from. They're all the heroes in their own stories. And then just the beauty of the Icelandic location, the way Alex shot it. It's my favorite sequence, maybe in all of Thrones.
It might be, it's certainly one of the most dazzling sequences. Cause like when we talked about Kiss by Fire, we talked about the Jaime and Brienne bath scene, and we talked about, you know, both Nicola's performance in that and Gwendolyn's performance in that. This Gwendolyn's performance in Kiss by Fire is so good for a million reasons, but a lot of it is obviously reactionary. Watching her do this is it's even more Brienne. And like watching that first Arya interaction where they're meeting each other as like women with weapons and sort of like the self-recognition and the warmth there, and then the immediate like concerned hands on hilts sort of like situation. And then I watched the interaction several times because I just wanted to stare at Gwendolyn's face the whole time. And then I also kept getting distracted by the like beautiful green hills behind her and kept like going back and forth, and I was like, I don't know where to keep my eyes. So the answer is
that location was astonishing. That was an astonishing location. And yes, you're absolutely right. The subtle, again, it's all faces. I mean, we've talked about this last time, and both Maisie and Gwen, when they see that, they recognize each other. They understand each other immediately. And what's so great about that I think the other reason this is my favorite sequence is it's a wonderful example of all of the threads that we've been laying for all of these characters and all of the external events kind of crashing together. You know, the Hound notices the Lannister gold in his sword because he knows Lannister gold. He's been growing up with it his whole life. Like the way the guys, I think, David and Dan weaved in the sort of mythology in ways that are, again, about character. And it's heartbreaking because ultimately they should all be on the same side.
Yeah.
And that's what I think so gut-wrenching about the sequence. And Arya, who, you know, has needed a protector, you know, now she's got two, and yet they they can't, you know, there's no way to really explain, you know, what's happened at this point. And they've all been so hurt, the three of them, up until this point, that it could only erupt in this horrible, brutal thing. And then her leaving him, I remember being so impressed with Maisie's poise and her discipline in being able to play that scene without an ounce of external emotion, you know, just cold. But yet not, you know, I think you still sense that there's something there between them. So it's, I mean, for someone as young as she was to pull that off is extraordinary. But Alex was great at those kinds of scenes too. He was really terrific with the actors, and taking them through it beat by beat. So it's a great sequence. It's a great sequence. And another thing that's fun about it too is just in terms of the light, we assumed that everything would be overcast at that time of year in Iceland. And if you watch very carefully, when Arya meets Brienne in the first section of the scene, and she's up there doing her little water dance, it's one of my favorite shots actually in the whole show as well, when she comes upon her practicing, mm-hmm. That's a gloomy overcast day. The next day we had to shoot the fight, and it was bright, bright sunlight, like Sergio Leone, blasting sun on you. And I remember Annette, our amazing director of photography, was just, you know, couldn't believe it. It's like, what is this? What are we going to do? And she, of course, being the genius that she is and everything, that, you know, you can sort of see when the fight starts, it's a little brighter. But they just leaned into it and made it work. And it has this wonderful kind of spaghetti Western feel to it.
Yeah.
And you don't really notice it, but I remember that was an example of the amazing crew just rolling with the punches, which we did all the time in terms of weather and things we couldn't control.
Well, so I want to contextualize this episode a little bit in like the larger narrative of Game of Thrones, which is this.
Absolutely.
This is an early example that I can recall of something seen on screen kicking up a really huge fight among the book readers loving the show, because I love the Brienne and the Hound fight. You love the Brienne and the Hound fight. What I was reminded of rewatching it was this argument that happened all of a sudden of book readers being like, no way Brienne of Tarth could beat the Hound in combat. This is ridiculous. Like, it was just sort of this hilarious.
I have two words for that, which is fuck that, but.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, it was a revealing moment, I think, for the fandom, which is just sort of, and the beginning of some other, you know, interactions to come of book readers feeling certain things. You know, do you have anything beyond that two-word response, or we can just...
In terms of story, we did wound him. So I just want to remind everyone, he is, if you need a reason for Brienne to beat the Hound, he was wounded in the earlier episode. Rhaegar bites him.
Right.
And it kind of festers. So he's sort of, the idea is that he's a bit weakened, a bit. I don't necessarily think you need that as an excuse, but if that makes anyone feel better, great. You know, in terms of Look, it's always a tricky thing when you talk about the book changes and you know, talking about why you come to certain decisions. A, it's kind of hard to remember exactly why. In some cases, I think in this case it was, very simply. I remember it was, I think, David's idea. I remember him pitching it to us in the previous season. We're shooting season 3, mm-hmm. and he pitched that idea. He said, "What if it's Brienne that wounds the Hound?" And before Arya, and we all just went, "Well, yeah, of course," because again, we're making a TV show here, and there are only a certain amount. I mean, as many characters as we have, you know, there's about 4 times as many in the book. And I think when we decided we were going to expand the Arya Hound storyline and then make an entire an entire season's worth of story. You know, to have the climactic fight that wounds the Hound come from some random person attacking him, we just felt it wouldn't have the dramatic payoff it needed. Again, for the medium that we were writing it for.
Yeah.
You know, a novel is different. So that was the
the
reason.
I didn't mean to make you like have to defend it, because I think it's a great adaptation.
Oh, no.
It reminded me of maybe one of the earliest squabbles that happened, you know, of many squabbles.
Right.
And there will always be squabbles in a matter of an adaptation. It was just sort of like an early hilarious.
Book 4 is where, but book or season 4 and the latter half of the third book is where, you know, the adaptation started to become, I guess, freer. Although it had been pretty much from the beginning in a lot of ways, but yeah. Breaking up that big book that is told from POV chapters meant a lot of reshuffling. And I was actually struck, I forgot that there are one or two pretty notable sequences that are from book 5, which I just had forgotten. I'm almost positive the child, the charred bones of the child put at Dany's feet is from book 5, and her closing up the dragons. Sure that the attack in the cave is from book 5.
Yeah.
So that was when it really became about the rhythm of the storytelling of the show, you know, dictating when certain events took place a little more. And of course, when we tackled books 4 and 5 together in season 5, that, you know, that became a whole other animal. But yeah, I guess season 4 is when that stuff started to happen a little bit more.
And then, you know, on the flip side of that, I distinctly remember the children being a moment when TV critics, more than ever, you know, whatever those people's value is, sort of sat up and took attention of like this as your most triumphant finale. You know, Game of Thrones was so famous until then of having these huge penultimate episodes and then the wrap up table setting sort of episode at the end of the season. And this felt like, you know, especially with Arya leaving Westeros, with everything that happens with Tyrion leaving Westeros too. And then the big, like choral Ramin Djawadi score kicking up at the end. It just felt like a big bow to put on the end of this great season. And so, what was both your intention in maybe making this a splashier finish than when we've seen before? And then what was your reaction when it was received so well?
Again, the story just kind of lays out the way it lays out. I don't think we were necessarily thinking, oh, you know, we're going to make a finale that's a bit more propulsive or a bit more epic and event-filled this year. Because I don't really think it was conscious. I think in many ways, it's because, you know, the end of the third book is just bananas.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, it comes back to George. I mean, what are a number of battles or two or maybe even three battles in the book, engagements in the book, would become kind of one episode for 9.
The Battle of Castle Black.
So, yeah, Battle of Castle Black. Because it, just on a practical level, that made the most sense to do it that way, but I think it worked story-wise too. So that left a lot of big story threads and events for the finale. And actually, if there's any demerit against The Children as the greatest episode of Game of Thrones, it's Sansa, who's maybe my favorite character along with Jaime, isn't in it. And the reason, and that there wasn't room for, so we end Sansa and Theon seasons in episode 8.
Yeah.
Of season 4.
Yeah.
Because there was just so much. So I don't know. It all just sort of, again, it's kind of the rhythm of the story sort of laying naturally. You know, we knew we didn't want to end episode 9 with Stannis riding in with the cavalry because it would feel too rhythmically like Blackwater, you know.
Yeah.
Where the cavalry comes in and saves the, so it would have felt like too much of a remake of Blackwater. So we thought, okay, well, how do we make it work where you open the finale with it? So it kind of just lays out that way, and as a result you have a slam bang action sequence at the beginning of the finale, which wasn't typical for us at the time, and just the emotional roller coaster that happens. I mean, it was fun watching this after having just talked to you about Kissed by Fire, because I'd forgotten how powerful that Tywin Cersei scene is.
It really is.
Which was invented for the show. I mean, at this point in the books, Cersei is not a POV character. So that was, and then Charles is working. I mean, both of them. I mean, Lena is amazing in this episode. I think. I mean, she's amazing in general. But you sort of see Cersei. You sort of see the Cersei that's going to sit in the Iron Throne, kind of coming out in this episode, in some ways. And I think the work Charles does when she tells him the truth about her and Jaime, it's the only time you really see him crack in the whole series. He doesn't even really crack at the end when Tyrion's about to kill him, because he just figures, I'll get out of this.
Yeah, yeah. I'll pull my pants up and this will be fine. I'll figure this out.
Yeah, yeah. I'll get out of this. He's not really going to kill me.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that moment where he says, no, I don't believe you, and twitches like that, I think that's the first time and the only time in the whole series you see Tywin really, you know, crack.
Yeah.
And it's thrilling. You know, again, it's a testament to Charles's discipline in all of the other scenes. The lesser actor shows his cards in other scenes.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I like to think we wrote it that way too, and he's just doing what we wrote, but you know, that seems great. Sorry, I got off on a tangent. I forget why. Oh yeah. It's the finale. It's just a lot. There's a lot to it. And, but I do remember it feeling special. I do. I remember when we aired, I remember being very proud of it when it aired. And to answer your question about the reaction, it's funny. The reaction I remember most and being so annoyed by is, people just annoyed that Lady Stoneheart didn't appear.
Yeah.
And I understand why people might be annoyed about that. But I remember thinking to myself, okay, fine, granted, but did you watch the other hour? Like, aren't you at least appreciative of that?
Yeah.
You know, yep. That's what you sort of want to scream when you work so hard on something.
Of course it is.
Okay. I'm sorry Ed Sheeran annoyed you, but did you watch the rest of it? Did you like that? Because you're spending a lot of time bitching about Ed Sheeran,
yeah.
Who I think did a nice job, but that's a different episode.
Well, it's funny because I was, you know, on a personal note, I was re-listening to, you know, an early podcast that I did at the end of season 4. Because actually one of our listeners was like, you guys should go back and listen to yourselves at the end of season 4. It's hilarious. So I was listening to it.
Uh-oh.
And I was just like, I was so stuck up and book fussy at that time in my life. I'd like to believe I've come some distance since then, but like, the notion of like slight adaptive changes were still like so perturbing to some people, maybe including myself. And now you're just sort of like,
sure,
with time and distance, seeing the larger story that you guys are telling.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I should be clear. I would never say someone should feel something about an episode. I mean, you feel how you feel.
Oh yeah.
And but look, there are choices we've made that I look back on and go, oh, you know. But I just remember specifically because I was so proud of that episode. I thought it was such a,
yeah,
in some ways a leap forward, and the filmmaking was so amazing. And I thought, and I season 4 is my favorite. Season 4 is certainly my favorite season. So I just remember being like, oh, but guy, you know, okay, fine, yes.
Well, yeah, so...
You were hoping Lady Stoneheart would be here, but come on!
So an example of that, an example of, like, a healing conversation I had around that is, you know, in my book fussy mode, writing about that episode for Vanity Fair years and years and years ago, I said, well, you know, in the book, the Tyrion departure is much darker. His goodbye with Jaime is very, like, angry and awful and divisive. And, like, why did they change that? And my editor, my lovely editor, Katie Rich, who's still an editor and a good friend of mine, you know, sat me down and said, Joanna, there's so much devastation in this episode. We could not have handled that emotionally. She's like, I'm glad they made that change. And so the darkness of Tyrion, which takes a real turn at this point in the books and has been handled differently in the show. You know, as much as you can talk about that, what were some of the choices around the treatment of that character?
That's an example of the book fan in me doing the same thing in production, where, you know, we had certainly mentioned Tysha, the first wife. And for the listeners, I don't know, maybe you talk about this when you talk with Richard in the podcast, but basically in the books, you find out in that scene where Jaime springs Tyrion that, oh, by the way, all those years ago, that girl that I said I hired as a whore, she actually wasn't. She actually did love you.
Right.
That the whore part was a lie. And it's very powerful and, you know, and there are repercussions throughout and all of that. As I recall, we had originally, I think in the very first outline, that was in there. And at some point it wasn't. I can't remember at this point if it didn't make the final outline or if it did. And then when the first draft of the script came out, it was gone or whatever. And I remember my book fan self went, nah, what's going on? But then I sat back and thought about it, and now rewatching it, I absolutely stand by the choice. There's a couple of things. One, the Shay love story was a love story in our show, and the character was a bigger, deeper part of Tyrion's storyline.
Right.
So to undercut what an audience, many of whom never read the books, has been experiencing for four seasons with the two of them, to undercut the dramatic payoff and emotion of that storyline with a character we've heard mentioned three times.
Right.
It's bad storytelling. Now, it's not bad storytelling in the books, because in the books you're in Tyrion's head.
Right.
And
you've been reminded
all the time. Yeah. And you've really experienced all of that. And we're not a flashback show. If we were a flashback show, we would still be flashing back, because there's too much to flashback to. And there's only so many times you can organically mention Tysha and the first marriage in a dialogue scene without it seeming really forced. So, we could have mentioned it nine more times, maybe in the episodes leading up to it. But there was no way that it wasn't going to feel, again, in the context of the medium that we were writing for, there was no way it wasn't going to feel forced and out of place. And even just rhythmically, even where Jaime is in his story, the fact that on screen, Jaime has never talked about the Tysha scene. So to have a character who, again, if you're just screwing with a TV show, bring up this subplot that you haven't really thought about in a while, in the middle of everything else going on, it just would have thrown off the whole thing. So it was an adaptation. It's a choice I stand by, I guess.
No, yeah, but it's like, it's that, you know, famous butterfly effect that we talk about in Game of Thrones, where, like, you know, Jaime tells Tyrion this, and Tyrion in revenge in the books, right, lies and says he killed Joffrey. And that really, you know, fractures that relationship. And then, as you say, we're inside Tyrion's head. And for the rest of the time that we've had with him in George's books, Tyrion is a much angrier person than what we've seen Peter Dinklage portray in the show. Was there ever, in addition to the adaptive choices that you're just talking about, was there ever an adaptive concern of, like, we don't want Tyrion, one of our heroes on the show, to be quite so alienating to audiences with the degree of darkness that he experiences in the books?
I can't speak to any conversations that were had between David and Dan about it, but I don't remember it ever being, you know, and I'm not, I don't mean to paraphrase what you're saying, but there was never a he's going to be unlikable if he does X conversation.
Yeah, I was trying to skirt the word likable. Yeah, but no, fair enough. That's exactly what.
I don't remember that ever being a concern, and I don't that would not be a concern of Peter's at all. I think we challenged ourselves in terms of writing and shooting that sequence where he kills her, because again, in the book, he doesn't, I mean, you know, he's sort of obsessed with her, but it's not the relationship that we had on in our show. So there was a bit of a self-defense element and a panic thing sort of thrown into it. I don't remember her ever pulling a knife and trying to kill him and essentially starting the fight in the book. I think that's something that we added to sort of give it more of like he chokes her to death. I'm not trying to let him off the hook,
right?
But it's done in a more heated, you know, fight, as opposed to a pure, you know, you betrayed me, I'm killing you, bitch thing. If that makes sense. So yeah. You know, again, it's messy, which I've said this many times.
You like
to you, I like messy.
Your favorite,
so
yeah.
I really like that scene for that reason.
But
that was an example of a choice that, you know, we would have loved to have honored in terms of the adaptation, but it just didn't, where we had brought the characters in the show universe, it wouldn't have worked. I also don't think, given all of the time that we, because, you know, for instance, in season four, you know, if season four is Tyrion's Law and Order episode, you know, Jaime was his counsel, his lawyer, essentially. And in the book, that's Kevin Lannister, who comes to him in the cell and sort of advises him on what's going to happen and everything. And in the show, it was Jaime. So he and Jaime had a hell of a lot more FaceTime and intimate moments in the show. It would have been hard, I think, to pull off Tyrion telling him I murdered Joffrey and Jaime believing him.
Given all
in the context
time.
Of what we've done in the show.
Yeah, that makes
sense.
In the
book, absolutely, because they've barely seen each other. But they've spent a whole season together in the show. So it's stuff like that where, you know, I think the butterfly effect, which you mentioned and George has mentioned, it's true. Like, you make one little adjustment and you have to kind of see it through and not try to shoehorn things where they won't fit. But it's that was the fun puzzle that I sort of missed. I obviously love the last few seasons of the show, but
it's adaptation.
The puzzle of adaptation.
Yeah,
the puzzle of adaptation was always fun for me. Just in terms of just process. I really enjoyed that.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining me for this episode of Joanna Unintentionally Makes Brian Cogman Defend Adaptive Choices, when actually she really liked this episode a lot.
I love everybody. Love you. Love you all, fans. It was fun to watch the episode again. I really dug it.
All right. Well, Brian Cogman, thank you again for chatting Game of Thrones with me.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. So that is it for our episode on season 4, episode 10, The Children. Next time, we'll be leaping forward to season 5, episode 9, Hard Home. So that's your assignment, season 5, episode 9, Hard Home. This episode was edited and produced by Dave Gonzalez. Until next time. Richard, where can people find you?
I mean, I want to say that I'm going to be in a tree learning the future, but I'm probably going to be on the toilet. To be honest. But I'll also be on Twitter at ryelazvf.com. And Joanna, where can people find you?
Oh, you can find me in a lab poking and prodding, you know, the mountain to see if I can bring him back to life. Otherwise, you can find me on VF.com or on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and we will see you next time.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.